Love letter number 7, your ultimate reality, no death, no fear. Dear Mother Earth, you were born from the dust of distant supernovas and ancient stars. Your manifestation is but a continuation, and when you cease to exist in this current form, you too will continue in another. Your true nature is the ultimate dimension of reality, the nature of no coming and no going, no birth and no death. This is also our true nature. If we're able to touch this, we can experience the peace and freedom of non-fear. And yet, because of our limited view, we still wonder what will happen to us when our physical form disintegrates. When we die, we merely return to you. You have given birth to us in the past, and we know that you will continue to give birth to us time and time again in the future. We know we can never die. Each time we manifest, we're fresh and new. Each time we return to the earth, you receive and embrace us with great compassion. We promise to train ourselves to look deeply, to see and touch this truth, that our lifespan is your lifespan, and your lifespan is limitless. We know that the ultimate and the historical, the noumenal and the phenomenal, are two dimensions of the same reality. Touching the historical dimension, a leaf, a flower, a pebble, a beam of light, a mountain, a river, a bird, or our own body, we can touch the ultimate. When we deeply touch the one, we touch the all. This is interbeing.
Unconditional love and care that Thich Nhat Hanh so obviously had for our beautiful planet. The letters sparked such a deep desire within me to do everything in my power to care for our Earth.
We forget
what these letters do so well is detail the incredible innate beauty of nature, and has this incredible way of not making it seem as though caring for our planet is a task or a choice, but it's a part of who we are. In daily life, as humans, we can so often forget about the insane amount of beauty there is in life and how incredibly lucky we are to live on such a beautiful planet who cares for us and provides for us with everything we could ever need.
For the health of our ecosystems and our water, our soil, and overall our planet.
Welcome. I'm Addison Brown, and this is the Emerging World Project podcast. What are you doing here? Before we began this season, where we would read excerpts from Love Letter to the Earth by Thich Nhat Hanh, I was thinking a lot about how much more we need to do. My feeling was that spirituality, an enlivened embracing of the unseen, was missing. We even asked several guests what spirituality meant to them, and most could not articulate it, but knew it was more of a feeling that moved them beyond the everyday actions of being productive. That feels like a really good start in what seems like to me is an urgent moment in our life on Earth, a time to startle our senses out of the habitual ways of seeing things and awaken to a full-bodied engagement in the wider life of the animate earth. I think of the future generations who have to pick up the mantle of leadership. I think of the challenges they are facing. I hope they learn from our mistakes and find some inspiration in our successes. I think of how the past always passes, how society evolves, how we can't hold on to where we were forever. Change and the circle of life are indelible parts of the human experience, and ultimately we will be judged by what we made of our time here on Earth. Wildlife vets have an insurmountable task ahead of them. They are on the ground face to face with so many animals that a lot of us just wish to experience in our own lifetimes, but not under these circumstances. It is a very, very sad juxtaposition. Sharon, our guest, tells us a beautiful story about treating a wounded bull elephant that is very popular with the humans and seemed to be more inclined to hang out with them even after he healed rather than out in the bush. There is a lot to be said about human-wildlife conflict, habituation, and its impact. In turn, I have a lot of questions about the rapid rate of extinction, wildlife care and conservation, and where do we think we are heading? We must change how we view wildlife conservation if we want to solve the biodiversity problem. Our guest today is Sharon Malindi. She is a wildlife vet and researcher. Sharon joins us from her mobile vet unit position in northern Kenya. The mobile vet unit tackles some pretty important conservation concerns to assist the regional Kenya Wildlife Service in interventions which include treatments, rescues, disease surveillance, and collarings. The mobile vet unit is sponsored by Save the Elephants, Owosso Lions, and Gray's Zebra Trust in collaboration with the Kenya Wildlife Service. Sharon.
Hi, Edison. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you. I'm good. I'm really looking forward to talking to you. I've been thinking about, and of course, doing some research the last few days. And this is one of my favorite conversations with folks like you that are on the ground and just right up close and personal to some of what I feel is the most important work that needs to be done these days. So I want to start by saying thank you. I know that you're busy. I know that you're in the field. So I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down and have a talk with us.
No, actually, thank you. Because in as much as we're doing the work, even just having, you know, our work passed on there and having a voice to air our concerns and what we do is just amazing. So thank you very much.
Wonderful. So Marley's going to join us in a little while. We're just going to do a little heavy lifting here first. And he's rather wonderful. I'll let you suss him out when he gets here in a little bit. All right. I'm going to start off by asking you, when would you say that you first noticed your relationship to the natural world?
So growing up, I had a really, really interesting childhood because my father is a biology teacher and he used to take us to really interesting trips. Whereas kids would go to like water parks and like really, really fun places, he would take us to the museum and animal orphanages and national parks. And at first we were like really, really, my brother and I were really, really, you know, annoyed because we're kids and we wanted to play and have fun and go out with other kids. And we didn't really see the importance of going to like the snake park or the museum. And we found it really, really boring. But later on, we came to realize that we loved it and it was very impactful on us because it really changed our relationship with animals and nature and even just learning about conservation. So with that and the fact that I had a lot of pets growing up just made me love animals and nature. And also something else that influenced it was trips to my grandmother's place. My grandmother had lots of cows and cats and dogs, and she had like a really amazing farm. And she always thought it was crazy that I was talking to the animals, but she really encouraged me to just do what has to be done. And yeah, that was really impactful in me understanding even the natural world, understanding that we have a connection to the environment and we have a connection to the animals, and it's just one big circle of life.
That's really wonderful. You had some really amazing early on influences. I can't even tell you how excited that makes me. Like, that is just so, it's just a beautiful way to segue into the work that you chose to do, which I'm guessing was greatly influenced by that as an early on experience. And you stayed the course. And I'm glad that you talked to animals, because they have to be a part of the conversation too, right? As we remember this circle of life, which some people are fortunate enough to be introduced to it early on, like yourself, which is so beautiful and brilliant. But this reminder, part of that is including all the beings in the conversations. So that's pretty darn cool. I really like that. And I'm guessing that that's what in particular made you want to be a wildlife vet, or I guess I'll let you answer that.
Yeah, that did have a big impact in my career choice. I always tell people that the exact moment that I knew I want to be a wildlife vet is I saw a vet dart out of a helicopter, and I'm afraid of heights, but I was like, I want to do that at least once in my life. I just want to do that. And yeah, I guess also during my childhood, the many, many trips I had to like the animal orphanage and, you know, the different parks in the country just really had a big influence on me. I'm a city girl. I've grown up in Nairobi for the better part of my life. And Nairobi is one of those unique cities that is, I think, the only city in the world that has a national park within it, within the city. And the frequent trips I made there, just, you know, seeing the Kenya Wildlife Service officers and the vets, that really, really encouraged me into, you know, trying to get into wildlife. And later on, I discovered that there's several other organizations that are into conservation. And I came to realize that maybe I can, you know, I can help conserve these animals. And yeah, I mean, I always knew I wanted to be a vet. And then I had that moment of, I want to be a wildlife vet. So,
right. Yeah. Did you, when you were living in Nairobi, it is really incredibly unique with the wildlife right in the middle of the city, or within the city. Mm-hmm. Did you develop a concern about how the wildlife would coexist within the space like that? And did you see, was it the suffering of the wildlife that you saw that made you want to help them?
I guess I've always just had this, you know, passion of I've just always loved animals. And when I tell you that I used to talk to cats and my grandma thought I was a bit nuts for doing that, but I've just always loved animals. And I also had this weird interest in, you know, medicine and surgery, and I thought it was cool. And I did end up applying that to, you know, my career choice. And in regards to the national park, I think when you're a child, you don't really, you know, see the impact. You don't see how the animals are. I guess for me, it was just like, ooh, I've seen a giraffe, I've seen a rhino. That's just made my day. But as I grew up, I came to realize and understand the challenges. You have this city that's growing at a rapid rate. Population is booming. And the spaces that wildlife have are just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And there's need for infrastructure to support the population growth, but there's no way that, you know, especially politicians and policymakers, they tend to forget that, you know, wildlife are also existing with, and we kind of, we're the ones who took their land. Mm. And as I grew up, I came to, you know, understand that there is, it's very challenging for the wildlife. It's very difficult for them, and their spaces are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And you come to, you know, learn about different mitigation measures that can prevent animals from, you know, suffering and population decline, like translocations and corridors. And I'm still learning about that. I think it's every day is a learning process. So I'm still learning about how, you know, even what I as a Nairobi citizen can do to make, you know, make it easier for wildlife to survive.
It is increasingly complex. So I do understand that the continuing to need to learn to see how we have to, or we can adjust and adapt and be inclusive to all beings. I want to talk about, you mentioned that you actually were kind of a nerd around medicine and surgery. I want to talk a little bit about your journey into becoming a wildlife vet, because it is a bit of a journey, isn't it?
It is. So once I finished my high school, I applied to the University of Nairobi and I did a bachelor's degree in veterinary medicine. It was a really long time because it was 5 years, and that school is very challenging. It's something that you don't expect. I think you think it's very straightforward. Then you realize you have to know the difference in anatomy between a cat and a dog and a snake and bees and, you know, all these different animals. And you realize that they have different physiologies. They have different approaches. And it's the course is also very physical. You have to be willing to be very physical when you're wrestling dogs or you're wrestling giraffes down, or, you know, you don't really learn that much in school until you get out into the field. So I was in University of Nairobi for 5 years. I graduated, and I was lucky to get an internship with the Impala Research Center right after. And that kind of introduced me to conservation. And I did that for a few months, and then I did a government-mandated internship with the Kenya Wildlife Service for 1 year. I was based at the Laikipia Kenya Wildlife Station with the Mobile Vet Unit. And honestly, I think the first day of me walking in there, in that office, basically just changed my life. So after I finished my Kenya Wildlife Service internship, I got a job that I love with the North Kenya Veterinary Mobile Unit, which is sponsored by Save the Elephants, Ewaso Lions and Grevy Zebra Trust in collaboration with Kenya Wildlife Service. So it's been like a really long journey, and I can honestly say that I am blessed and lucky that I am where I am, and I'm doing something that I love.
Oh, it is amazing. And you have quite some fortitude, because it isn't as straightforward, right? It's not just the anatomy of a cat, or you also have probably those challenges of a natural fear that arises, right? When one sees something that the brain just automatically goes, oh, I need to survive. I don't want to walk near this snake. So I would imagine the balancing of that with the work is really, really challenging, but also rewarding. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy for you. I'm so happy for you in a lot of ways. And one of the big ways is that someone with your obvious intellect and passion and understanding is, to me, the perfect person to be in the position that you're in the times that we're in. I think some of the biggest issues facing the natural world today, such as extinctions that are taking place at like 1,000 times the natural rate, poaching is escalating, habitat loss is consistently ignored in our desire to always be growing. And of course, wildlife crime in its complexity is largely fueled by myths that certain animal parts can cure human diseases. And I'm saying this because you talk about all the different areas that you are learning to understand and will need to continue to understand as we sort of tackle these problems in helping our wildlife survive. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk to me about Ritete, which is Africa's first indigenous community owned and run elephant sanctuary there in northern Kenya. Can you share with us a little bit about that sanctuary and the work that you are doing with them?
So firstly, the Ritete Elephant Sanctuary is located in Samburu County in northern Kenya, and it is run, well, majority run by the community, and it is just an amazing place. So I don't directly work with Ritete, but when I was an intern, I managed to volunteer for a couple of cases there. Mm. And it is such an amazing place where they, you know, have a sort of refuge and a safe haven for all these abandoned and orphaned elephants. And the local community, the Samburu people, who are just amazing, they, you know, take care of these animals, and they've come to, you know, they have an understanding with the wildlife, and they know that these animals, you know, belong to us, and that conservation shouldn't be a foreign thing. Mm. It should start with, you know, us, and it should start with the indigenous community and the people living there, and they should be able to spearhead conservation initiatives. And so they take care of these baby elephants and, well, other orphaned animals as well. And they're trying to rewild these animals. So they're trying to do a sort of, you know, rewilding so that the elephants can, you know, be integrated into the wild properly. And yeah, I'm very positive about how things are going to turn up in the future, and I'm happy and willing to see how that's going to turn out.
That is a really, it is a really important model of conservation that we're just beginning to see mm-hmm. come into existence more and more. I just want to backtrack a little bit. Now, if you could tell us a little bit about what rewilding is. So it's clear that whether they go, once they're rehabilitated, from an emergency, they go back into the wild, but is it a controlled wild space?
So it's more of a controlled setup. So when the elephants, well, let's say the animals come in, they're, you know, fed and cared for and given love, and they become stronger and they're mm-hmm. and healthier. And then in time, they have, I guess, small spaces where they can go and, you know, discover themselves and learn how to be, you know, learn from themselves. And their instincts just kick in and they learn how to be, you know, elephants. What happens is, I guess they're developing a sort of model where you don't want the animals to be too habituated and too accustomed to, you know, being fed and being around humans. And I guess they slowly take them to locations where they can, you know, they're like obviously the protected locations, but locations where they can monitor them and encourage them to just, you know, be themselves and have their instincts kick in. And then eventually after that, they're usually taken to another location that doesn't really have humans, but is, you know, in a protected sanctuary of sorts. And then I guess slowly they do interact with wild elephants, and they should be able to reintegrate. And I don't know, I'm being very positive, and I hope to see that in future. I haven't really been in Samburu long enough to see that, but I'm sure there are people who've witnessed that, and it would be so amazing to just, you know, see that with my own eyes.
Yeah, it most definitely would. It, again, I keep using this word complex because I have a lot of people that I just want to clarify. You know, after the emergency happens and an animal goes to a rehabilitation center and they're re-released, some places re-release them back into the world and some re-release them into these protected areas. And why, you know, unfortunately, we have to have so many protected areas because we're just taking over the place. Humans are just taking over the joint. So I just wanted to clarify that. I want to ask you about some types of emergencies that you come across in particular in that region. And because you had to not only learn the anatomy of all of these beautiful creatures, you probably have to understand where they fit in the ecosystem and how important that is, since this is all interrelated and interconnected. Can you tell me what types of emergencies you come across? And then we'll just follow that up with what role the elephant plays in that ecosystem.
So Northern Kenya is a very interesting and complex region in the country where you have a lot of free-ranging wildlife that interact very freely with the communities up there. So a lot of times the emergencies that we usually encounter include cases of human-wildlife conflict, which are increasing, obviously, because animals are having less spaces and humans, like you said, are just taking over. And we get a lot of cases of human-wildlife conflict where you have elephants being speared or shot, or, you know, maybe they went too close to a watering hole and someone got scared and, you know, shot them. Or maybe the elephants sniffed out something good in someone's granary and, you know, went and raided their homes. Or unfortunate incidences where you get, you know, people being injured or unfortunately even killed. So human-wildlife cases have, you know, there are a lot of human-wildlife cases in the region, and it usually becomes an emergency. And I can say that most of them are treatments where you know, you're treating bullet wounds and spear wounds, but I think rescues should also come into that human-wildlife category, because we're also finding that there are a lot of animals that, you know, sometimes are being abandoned, or, you know, they're just an animal whose mother has been killed and you need to just, you know, swoop in and rescue the animal and take it to a sanctuary or a protected area. So treatments, we do rescues, we do, I wouldn't say collarings are emergency situations, but sometimes you need to call a problematic animal. Let's say you have an elephant or a lion that's going into human territory, if I can say that. The animals are going into human areas and it wouldn't be good to just collar them and try and see, okay, this animal is going towards a human settlement. How can we drive it away, or, you know, chase it away? Or you look at the movement patterns of those animals and just figure out why do they keep going to this specific area that ends up results in them getting, you know, injured or attacked or injuring someone. So I guess those are some of the emergencies we're seeing. I guess also right now, because of the drought situation, we're seeing a lot of, you know, animals that are weak and dying. And those are emergency situations where we try and, you know, just save the animal when we can. And in cases of, you know, dead animals, we try and establish the cause of death, because I guess it's more of, you know, a disease surveillance emergency, because you want to understand why this animal died, because drought situations usually result in, you know, disease outbreaks such as anthrax.
So is there any active intervention, or is it a happenstance, right? Are you, like, you just happen upon a deceased animal, or is there an active intervention, which I guess could be as simple as rangers combing the land, right?
Yeah, so it's both of them. Sometimes we just stumble across, or like someone from a community member or the rangers or the various organizations will be notified that there's an animal carcass here and it's this many days old, or it just died right now. And you go and do the postmortem. But at the same time, we also are trying to do, you know, a more proactive way of understanding the situation. Recently we had a grevy zebra, you know, we went around looking at grevy zebra, looking at the body conditions, trying to see where the different water sources are, and then where the feeding programs can be implemented. So it's a bit of both. We try and you know, just do a bit of both.
Right. It seems a little daunting sometimes. Besides the fact that we, you know, most people love elephants, baby elephants, and zebras and lions and deer and snake and all the beauties. I'm finding that it's important to understand beyond our natural love for them, the role that they play in keeping the cycle of life and the biodiversity. It's important to our own life. Can you share with us just a little bit what role, let's say, the elephant plays?
So I work with Save the Elephants and also two other organizations, Ewasu Lions and Grevy Zebra. So at Save the Elephants, we try and understand, you know, how elephants, we understand firstly that elephants are just, you know, an important species, and we try and understand their impact on the, you know, environment and their impact on conservation and tourism, and even, you know, their impact on humans. So it's more of trying to do research into why elephants are, you know, population numbers are decreasing, and how can we mitigate that and ensure that population numbers start to increase again? And how can we protect those animals, and, you know, how can we change perspectives and change opinions within humans so that they can act upon it to protect these animals themselves? That's a very, like, you know, summarized version of what exactly they do. And I guess the different organizations also, you know, do that. And I guess the key thing is trying to promote, you know, conservation within the community so that they can just encourage, you know, better living and coexistence with the animals.
Right. I read this really wonderful article just a couple of days ago about a Buddhist nun in Thailand who is working with, I believe it was the USAID, and they teach classes to younger people about this, not only the pragmatic importance, but the spiritual importance. And one of the questions, I'm sharing this with you because one of the questions that the interviewer asked her at the end was really wonderful. She said, and so, you know, how do you see the impact? And the nun said, children love to tell their parents what to do.
That's true.
You know, so mom, you may not want to, you know, smash that bug or so, you know what I mean? Or like, let's lose the rat trap or so, I don't know. But it was just like the perfect answer. Like, right, in the complexity, there's also the simplicity that, you know, our young people, not only upon learning it, will then, you know, teach us, because a lot of us just have to have a little bit of a shift in our mindset. But I just thought that was brilliant. Love to tell them what to do.
Hello, everyone. I'm your co-host, Marley. Today, we're going to welcome Sharon to our off-the-top questions. They are a series of 10 questions, and you have to guess them as fast as you can. Are you ready? Let's begin. What animal would you be in another life?
A cat.
Who are you in 5 words or less?
Enthusiastic, fit, really short, love my job.
Do penguins have knees?
That's an interesting question, yes. Yes, they do. They have probably very, very tiny knees.
What do you do when you can't sleep?
I look for a book that, you know, I love reading storybooks. And I just read a story and I fall asleep.
What is the best thing about your life at this very moment?
The fact that I'm doing what I love and I'm surrounded by very encouraging and very positive people. And even when I'm feeling low and I'm feeling like I can't do this and the imposter syndrome kicks in and I feel horrible, they always have a way of just making me feel like I can do this and I am in the right place.
If you could have an unlimited supply of one thing, what would it be?
Pineapples. I really like pineapples, and then at the same time, I love to encourage people to have more fruit, and pineapples just happen to be my favorite fruit.
If your life was a story, what would it be titled?
The Hills. My life so far has just been a series of up and down and up and down. I'm loving every moment of it, the good and the bad.
What subject do you find to be the most fascinating?
Biology.
What object do you lose the most?
I had a phone get run over by a Land Cruiser, so I don't have a really good track record with phones.
Which book impacted you the most?
I'll give you 2. So there's an autobiography that I read, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. It really opened my head into, you know, understanding politics and human nature. So that really impacted me. And second book is a book that I was gifted by an older vet. And it's a book by James Herriot, who is a famous vet author. And I thought that I'd hate the book, but I ended up liking it. All things great and small.
How would you describe humanity to aliens?
Oh, God, that would be... I think that would be a challenge in itself, because we're so diverse and, you know, so different. And I would probably write a book just attempting to describe humanity, but I'd tell them that, you know, we're just a bunch of unique, random people just living life, trying to get by, and hopefully at the end of it, we'll see that we did our best.
What do you think is most important to save wildlife?
I think it's not really one thing. It's more of, there are a lot of things that I needed to, that are important to save wildlife. You have, firstly, like you said, a shift in mindset. You can't just, you know, save something you don't care about. You have to care about it. And humans are very emotional beings. And I think in as much as, you know, we are emotional beings, it's an advantage to us, and we should attach that to, you know, saving wildlife, because you come to understand it from, you know, it's more direct for you to understand if you're emotionally invested in something. So changing someone's mindset is usually the first thing you need to do about, you know, saving wildlife. I'll use Kenya as an example. You need to tell people that these are your animals. Mm-hmm. You live with them. You need to be, you know, this is why it's important to save them. And once people have that mindset, they put an effort to, you know, saving these animals, and they understand how these animals impact their lives, be it the communities that live with these wildlife, or even people in the towns who don't really, you know, see all these animals all the time. But, you know, even just shifting their mindset and telling them, you might live in Nairobi, but, or you might live in a big town, but you can be a domestic tourist and, you know, go and see these animals and put your mark on conservation. So changing mindset is, for me, one of the most important things. The other thing is, you know, just getting the word out there about why it's important. And, you know, this comes a lot with, you know, social media and other methods of communication where, you know, the world is a global village and you want someone far away to understand that this is what we're doing and this is how you can help to save the wildlife. Yeah, I think there's so many things, even from a veterinary perspective, you know, training more veterinarians in wildlife, you know, encouraging even young people to understand that they can do this and commit to themselves is just really important. So if I can just summarize that in like one word, I think making people understand that they are important in this whole narrative is the most important thing.
I would have to agree with that, very much so. But I'm a little surprised to hear about the need. Is there a need for more wildlife veterinarians?
I'd say in Kenya and in Africa and probably around the world, you can never have too many vets. You can, like, giving an example, in northern Kenya, there are not too many vets. I work under the KWS veterinarian. So there's two of us in a unit, and there's the vet at Retete, the two vets at Retete. And there's so many different vets around that area, but it's never enough because you'll always find there's so much to do and like the work never stops. So I do think that there should be more people joining, more, you know, people joining veterinary, wildlife veterinary practice because the work will never stop.
Yeah, which is sad. It's a sad commentary because a lot of the injuries are precipitous of our behavior, our unchecked behavior. So can you tell me about maybe a particular memorable patient you treated and why was that patient so memorable?
I'll tell you about two. So
thank you.
I think one of my most favorite was we had one of the first ever case that, you know, I did and I was, you know, in charge of, well, not really in charge of, but I was an intern and there was a KWS vet with me and he told me, you know what, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to stand and watch you and I want you to take over this. And it was a mountain bongo who unfortunately had a rectal prolapse. And I was terrified. I was so terrified because I had never darted a live animal before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was so nervous. I was like, what am I going to do? I'm running all the medication and this is what I'm going to give. This is what I'm going to do. And I'm asking him, can you help me? He's like, nope, tell me what you're going to do first. And I was shaking. And he, like, my supervisor literally just told me, stop panicking first. You can do this. And the case went smoothly. And I was surprised. And once we were finished, he's like, you were panicking for no reason. And for me, that was just, it's like one of the most memorable cases because it went well. And I kind of had a moment where I was just like, I need to believe in myself a bit more. And it was just, it just changed my whole, you know, outlook of veterinary medicine. And I realized it's also very psychological. You need to tell yourself that you can do this.
Right. You have to be able to count on yourself so that background conversation with yourself was hugely important. Exactly. And you're the only one that can give yourself that conversation. It's amazing transformative moment. Then you just carry it with you. Okay, story number two.
So story number two. So when I first came to save the elephants, I was told that there's a resident elephant called Sarara, and this guy usually passes through camp. And I think one day I was waking up to go to the loo, and I just saw an elephant right outside my house, and I just stood there. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I took out my phone and started taking pictures. And it was just funny because I was just so amazed. And everyone else in the camp was just like, he's always here. Like, you know, it was just like he's like a pet. Well, not really a pet, but he's just always there. So unfortunately, a couple of months ago, Sarara strayed too close to, you know, humans. And I don't really know what the interaction is, but he was speared in the belly. Mm-hmm. And one of the Save the Elephants, longtime monitoring experts, I should call them. So he spotted him and he reported the case to the, you know, KWS vet in charge. And we went and, you know, had this amazing intervention where we darted him and he took some time to fall. Goodness. And then he went down and everyone was just there because, you know, he's someone who's, he's like an elephant who's loved by so many people in the reserve.
My goodness.
In Samburu. And I think both me and the vet would, and you know, the KWS team were just... we're just like, we need to help this guy out because we've kind of become attached to him. Mm. And I'm so sure he holds such a special place in the hearts of so many people in Samburu. So we treated him and, you know, we're running around and our heads are spinning and the treatment was just successful. And he stood up and he seemed okay.
My goodness.
He just walked away. And, you know, usually when you treat free-ranging wildlife, it's like you treat them and they just disappear. But then Sarara, and it's a bit funny, but it's like he spent more time in our camp during that period when he was, you know, healing. And it was just amazing to see him and just have someone tell you, yeah, I saw him today, his bump looks better or his wound looks better. And it was just, you know, amazing to just see that, to see how the wound was progressing and how he was feeling and his reaction to the humans around him. And
oh, wow.
It was really special. Mm-hmm.
That's so special. Oh my gosh. Do you remember the first time that you were up close to an elephant that had been darted? That wasn't your first time, was it?
That wasn't my first time, but my first time was just amazing because I remember it was a big bull and my supervisor had darted it and I was supposed to give, you know, the antibiotics and the painkillers. And I think when he went down, because I was in awe and I kind of forgot that I was a vet for like a few minutes. And I just went and started touching his skin and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And, you know, looking at his trunk and looking at the ears and touching the tusks. And I was just so amazed and taking pictures. And then my supervisor was like, ahem. I was like, okay, I snapped back. I snapped back and remembered that I was a vet. And yeah, it was such, I can't even describe the feeling of, you know, touching all these animals, or even just not only elephants, even just elephants and lions and zebras and giraffes and all these animals, you know, touching them up close is just a dream come true. And
I can imagine. I mean, the reason why I ask you that question, it's going to lead into my next question, because there is this desire to be up close. And, you know, unfortunately, up close and touching for you, you know, is at a time when they really need your assistance. But that feeling, that connection that happens when you are up front, right? Like when I could tell you so many stories when I'm with different animals, but we're connecting, right? I'm not just looking at them on a screen or through a fence or something, but I'm having a real connection. And that is like medicine. It is some sort of medicine.
It feels so good.
It really does. And that's why I asked you, like, what I saw the image of you with that, maybe the gentleman you were just talking about. but the image that you sent me. But okay, so this was leading into a question before I started to get off track here. If you look at, let's say, prairie dogs in America, gray wolves and bison, and you can link so many species that would have been extinct directly without the work of zoos. Mm-hmm. Okay, so having said that, what is your feeling about animals in captivity at zoos and circuses with regards to the future?
It's usually hard to, you know, have one opinion on zoos because you can't say zoos are bad and you can't say zoos are good. Personally, for me, I feel that zoos are incredible in helping with conservation because sometimes you want to do research into how you can better your treatments and better your protocols and, you know, help animals better. And doing research on free-ranging wildlife is very, very difficult. So sometimes it is necessary to, you know, do research on captive animals and then extrapolate that research to free-ranging animals, and hopefully that will positively impact conservation. However, I don't think that works for every single species, but it does work for a lot of species. But at the same time, I do feel a certain way about, you know, seeing an animal that is in, you know, an enclosed space where they can't just, they don't have the freedom and, you know, that instinct of going wherever they want or using this migratory route, or, you know, just they don't have that freedom. And sometimes it is a bit sad. But I'm sure that a lot of zoos are also considering animal welfare and how they can do enrichment so that these animals are, you know, in as much as they're captive, they're going to have a good life. And a lot of zoos are improving they're improving themselves so that they can give these animals the best life possible within the situations that they're in. So for the future of wildlife, I think zoos are crucial for, you know, disease surveillance or treatments or, you know, research that can be extrapolated to free-ranging wildlife. So it's like, it's a good and a bad. I'm not too happy with them, but they're doing such an amazing job at the same time. And they're amazing vets and amazing animal health practitioners, amazing scientists who, you know, are going to make, they're doing their best to make a really positive impact.
Right, right. Again, you know, we have to recognize that we're sort of, not sort of, but we're imbricated in all of the things that we're trying to get away from, which makes the situation challenging. Right, the zoos that are not accredited or that are not looking towards the future of that species or any particular species, but are just looking at consumerism or capitalism. So it's a really fine line. I wonder what sort of post-activism is going to look like. What I see a lot here with American zoos, a good many of our American zoos just fall way, 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 way below the standards that are necessary for a species like an elephant to be in a space and be thriving. It's not possible. So I'm wondering, you know, when we'll get to that understanding, right? So it's important to save certain species. It's just not, an elephant just never belongs in a space that's cemented and without others. Yeah, it's mind-boggling. But then the other work is as important as well. So I want to ask you about reimagining or imagining some sort of radical vision for how our world could look and be. And I'm certain that you probably have the hope for that.
I think right now we have this, we're heading in a direction, you know, of trouble. Climate change is here and it's real, and every single person needs to be concerned about it because it's impacting so many aspects of our lives. And personally, for me, I just, you know, I wish we could get to a point where people would, you know, take science seriously, where people would listen to scientists and people would listen to, you know, eco warriors and eco, you know, people who are promoting and pushing for a more, I think I should say, eco-friendly approach to life. We are heading towards a disastrous future, and if we don't change it now, we're going to have trouble, because just being in northern Kenya and seeing the impact of the drought, and even in other parts of the country and parts of the world, you come to realize how, you know, how severe this is. And I guess for me, in an idyllic world, people would listen to, you know, scientists and the evidence that's there, and everyone would, you know, be passionate and will understand that every single person has a small role to play, and that role in the future of our world is super important. However small, however you think it's insignificant, it is very, very important.
Right. Sometimes I think about, well, I think way too much about the tipping point that we're sitting upon.
Yeah.
And I have to constantly, moment by moment, rebalance. And sometimes that just seems that we're moving so quickly that we're not even taking the time. So the education and the education early on, and then allowing yourself to hear the science right before the flood is at your doorstep. We had some heat wave in the Midwest a couple of months ago, and I saw an image of all the cows that had suffered from the heat stroke. I thought about the people and who are used to seeing the cows, you know, roam around, and they're just part of their everyday life. And then they're lying, you know, deceased. Mm-hmm. And that's the point that I don't want everybody to have to get to, but here we are. Right. And so it's a little hard to imagine what it looks like consciously, like what it looks like for people across the board to change their consciousness. You mentioned something about research.
Mm-hmm.
You have an area of research that you're focusing on?
The funny thing about me is I think I'm still at that phase. You know, I recently just started my career, and I'm at that phase where I'm not 100% sure of what I want to do, but so far right now, I think I'm very interested in disease research and seeing the disease dynamics in, you know, wildlife species. And there's this very, very interesting concept that I learned during school, and I'm seeing how applicable it is, called One Health, which basically encompasses the health of animals, health of humans, health of the environment into one big sphere. And, you know, you can't, it's like a triangle, and you can't have a balance if you take one out. I think it will be really, really interesting to see, and I would love to do research into how to, you know, adopt the One Health framework into conservation medicine, because I've seen how it works with, let's say, rabies research in wild dogs and how wild dogs can be protected by vaccinating domestic dogs. You know, different, like how you can, you know, protect domestic animals from catching diseases from wildlife, which in turn also protects humans. And I don't know, it's such an interesting interface to just, you know, read on and hopefully do research on in future.
I think so. I think it is. I think, number one, human health has never been as poor as it is today. The onslaught of diseases since the 90s is just outrageous, what we're seeing with our system. So I think really understanding that interface, I love it. I think it's hugely important. I think it's really, really important. It's just unfathomable, the depth of disease that the human body is suffering just in the last 50 years. You know, things that we've never seen before in young people. And now discovering microplastics in blood and all this stuff is totally related. It's totally related. Is this similar to the work that, I remember who I was speaking with about vaccinating gorillas. Is that part of the same?
It is, because if you, let me give you an example. Right now, there's a sanctuary in Laikipia called Olpejeta, and they have a chimpanzee sanctuary, and the vet there is just amazing, and he usually puts in place protocols. And when COVID struck and vets around the world started establishing that COVID can jump to wildlife species and vulnerable species, they had to put in, you know, various policies to prevent COVID from, you know, spreading to the animals. And they had to make sure that people who would go there were COVID free and had been in isolation and were not carriers. And yeah, so it's similar. And then also, you know, another example would be even just vaccinating grevy zebra from anthrax. I guess eventually that builds up immunity in the zebra population. And in a way, if you look at it from like a really, really funny point of view, might help the other animals around, including the domestic animals. So it's very, very connected. It's very connected. And I think COVID has just taught us that.
Right.
Yeah, especially with, you know, neglected tropical diseases. I think veterinarians, especially wildlife veterinarians, have a key role to play in doing research towards, you know, understanding these diseases and how we can mitigate them and have healthier wildlife, healthier humans, and a better environment.
Right. This has to do with wildlife trafficking, which obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, plays a big role in disease. Can you break that down a little bit?
When you have animals being trafficked from one location to a location to another location that they're not, you know, native or they're not from, these animals are passing, first of all, illegally, because you're taking an animal out of its you know, habitat. You're taking these animals without proper permits, without proper licensing and licensure. You are, you know, undoubtedly causing a shift in the balance of that population. So when these animals are taken to different locations, they've not passed through, I mean, obviously it's illegal, but even if, you know, it was their trade laws, animals have to be, you know, examined by veterinarians to ensure that they're not, you know, you're not passing disease from one place to another. With illegally trafficked animals, there's nothing like that. So if a disease outbreak happens later on, it's very difficult to trace it. And it just becomes very chaotic for even the public health practitioners. Also at the same time, you take an animal from this population, take it to a different population without considering, you know, the naivety of disease of the other population. They're just different, very different factors that, you know, you consider in regards to disease in trafficked animals. It's very problematic because you don't know what diseases are being spread. You don't know who's exposed, the person trafficking, what they're exposed to, what they're taking, even the animals. It's a very complex disease framework, but...
Do you see yourself working with children at any point in terms like in education or something?
I do. I mean, I always feel like whatever I know I'm not exactly the most experienced vet, but I do know every single thing that I know, I would love to teach to someone else. And I would love if, you know, they become better than me and they pass that on and that person becomes better than them. So I would love, you know, to, you know, tell younger people younger than me, I guess,
mm-hmm.
that there's this incredible world and this is what I think of it and this is what is going to happen and this is what we can do to make it better, and this is what you can do to make it better. And I think it's a very fulfilling thing, just, you know, passing on every single piece of knowledge that I have. I don't know if this maybe influences it. I come from a family of teachers where my grandparents were teachers.
Oh yes, and definitely.
My parents are teachers, and I might not be one, but I do see the impact of, you know, passing on whatever knowledge that you have.
Agreed. So are you afraid of snakes?
Yes. I'm very afraid of snakes, but I think the only snake that I can, you know, catch without, you know, being fully
screaming.
Screaming is like a rock python.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
We've had a rock python case and I was just shaking the entire time.
Oh my god. So what did you tell yourself? How did you calm yourself down? Did you go back to that other incident and remind yourself, I can do this?
Yeah, I was just like, I can do this. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Just treat it like any other patient. And I have a friend, a colleague, she just loves snakes. So I think to get the fear out of me sometimes, I'm usually like, she's the first person I call. I'm like, what if you have a snake case, can I just tag along and hopefully get my fear, you know, get over my fear? But yeah.
Wow. I'll tell you my snake story, because mm-hmm. I see a lot of snakes in my hood. And some of them I know, you know, are docile and they won't harm me. And others I just don't know what kind they are.
Yeah.
So I was on a hike and it was a little bit of paved road before I got around this bend. And I heard all this ruckus, right? And I looked up about 40 feet up this bedrock and trees and mountains. And there's this ruckus and the birds are chirping. And I'm like, what is going on? Then all of a sudden I see the backside of a snake falling down with a squirrel. Whoa. Right? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like talking to the universe or something. Are you kidding me? And they just tumbled down. The rocks started coming and the birds came down, landed first on the road and are squawking. And then boom, it lands 2 feet in front of me.
Oh God. I would have run. And,
oh my gosh. I did probably what you did. I was like, okay, this is nature. He's just having lunch. It's not interested in you whatsoever. But you have no idea how my body reacted. It just was frozen, freaking out. And I didn't have that. I'm not one of those people that's curious to watch nature do its thing in that way, right? I understand mm-hmm. it. I respect it. I honor it. I think it's also a very intimate and private thing yeah. that some of us are edible and some of us, you know, eat others. But I did manage to see the life leave the squirrel. And, you know, I wasn't the same for about a week. So one of my friends said, well, you know, your brain is just going to do that. There are certain things you have to be afraid of for survival. Yeah. So don't try and override it. It's okay. I'm like, okay, you know, I'll remember that.
That's really good advice. That is really good advice. It's okay. It's okay to validate how you're feeling.
It is right.
I think sometimes you need to remind yourself that I am allowed to be scared because it's in me. It's an innate feeling.
Sharon, I want to thank you and everybody at the Emerging World Project that is going to be a part of this recording wants to thank you for taking the time and telling us about your unique and wonderful life. We appreciate it, and we appreciate the work that you have chosen to do and the work that you will continue to do.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, this is such an amazing experience. You know, meeting, even though we're not meeting in person, but e-meeting new people, and, you know, hopefully in future we'll be able to meet in person. And, you know, it's good to see the different types of people involved, and you know, it's an amazing experience. So thank you for having me.
Okay. Marley, would you like to say goodbye to our guest?
Yes. Thank you for being on this show. And I'm glad that you came, and I'm glad that I'm here.
Thank you so much, Marley, and I'm wishing you all the best in all your endeavors.
Thank you for stopping by. You can help us spread the word about What Are You Doing Here by sharing this episode or leaving a review in your favorite podcast app. Reviews help potential listeners see that our show is worth their time, and every single one makes a difference. For a deeper look at what the Emerging World Project is up to, head on over to emergingworldproject.org. The Emerging World Project studios are on Tongva land.